Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Monday, April 30th installment of the Heretics Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Yeager, and I will once again be with you for the next 2 hours. I have a program tonight that I can really enjoy. It's not a sensitive topic for me, like talking about other so-called truth tellers. But one that I can relish talking about, which is Adolf Hitler. Specifically, tonight, his death on April 30th, 67 years ago today, and his final political statement as dictated in his last testament. And I have a good guest to help me do this, someone new to the Heretics Hour, who will be coming on in the second hour. His name is Severus, also now known as Nefilson. Don't ask me, We'll ask him how he pronounces that on his new blog of that name, Nefilson's blog. We were spelled N-F-I-L-S-O-N. We were both on Bill Fink's Hitler birthday party program on Christigenia Saturday last April 21st, along with Brian and Bill. And I learned then what a nice discussion partner Severus can be. So sit back and enjoy tonight's show, and you may learn something about Adolf Hitler that you didn't know before. I bet you will. I'm going to first read From the Fire by Georg Friedrich, as I generally have been doing, and I'm in Chapter 3 still, the chapter entitled Land, and now in the South, the section called the South. I will start on page 271 about Würzburg, and then move on to Nuremberg, and end with a little bit about Munich, if time permits. I have got a reading lamp here on my desk tonight for the first time. And it's very nice for reading, so I can really see well. Let's see, though. It's hard to, a little bit of glare. To start out, excuse me, no other city had a similar collection of art treasures within such a small area. We're speaking of Würzburg. The greatest art treasure was Würzburg itself, a creation of Balthasar Neumann. Later on, people asked how it was possible to destroy 90% of a city, one with the main river running through it, in only 17 minutes. The answer was fate and number five. All British bombing techniques were geared to forestall firefighting efforts. Fire that achieved its peak intensity in the shortest amount of time could not be extinguished. Excuse me. The speed of ignition depended on the qualities of the object. This one lay in the valley basin, the weather conditions, and the ability of the fire raisers to deal with both of these aspects. That is, those were the conditions. According to reports, the flames caught quickly. As the British knew, Würzburg's typical Rococo architecture contained large amounts of wood, and the corresponding munitions were concentrated perfectly by number five. Squadron number five. The result is inconceivable. The city had previously been left virtually untouched by the bombing war, but its luck up to this point turned out to be its doom. Residents and rescue crews were not familiar with effective air raid conduct. They had only heard through rumors of the treachery of cellars becoming overheated and the concentration of combustion gases. There were no concrete bunkers. The 17th century fortifications had been last used during the religious wars, and even then only temporarily. The calming corridors in the depths had been left undisturbed and, though damp, were perfectly suited as shelters. But this diocesan city, with its art-blessed interior, believed itself to be free of any profound hostilities. Who could fail to love this Baroque fortress crowned with towers? Churchill knew Würzburg as a young attaché. He had entered his name in the Golden Book of the city. There were no warmongering industries here, just spinets and altars. Since the peasant wars, which the people of Würzburg fought with their own hands, the worst enemy they faced had been the Swedes, whose most dastardly deed was to steal a library, a compliment to both robbers and the robbed. Libraries were meanwhile treated in a different way, and thus the experienced destroyers of the Royal Air Force met a community very out of touch with reality. Then it describes a lot of the burning and the people gathered in the cellars and their fear and what happened to them. And I've read so much of that from other cities that I'm skipping that part. And continuing here on page 273, on March 16th, Würzburg lost about 5,000 of its 107,000 residents. 20 days later, the 7th U.S. Army took over the city. The last 3,500 German troops entrenched there fought a bloody six-day battle among the ruins. For the American forces, it was the most bitter urban battle since Aachen. In both cases, fighting in the ruins favored the hopeless defenders. If the city had been razed to the ground in preparation for its capture, it would have been a military miscalculation. In the end, Würzburg was destroyed as an alternative target on the February 8th objective list. It did not have to be associated with any military use. The destruction was understood as a brilliant coup in and of itself. Quote, south of the train station, as the British summary of operations of March 18th says, the old town has been almost completely destroyed. The same night, while Würzburg was burning, a unit that had started out 10 minutes before No. 5 Bomber Group turned southward at the Rhine. Now, this was March, 45. Southward at the Rhine, and then to the east at Rottenburg, reaching its destination, Nuremberg, at 10:15 p.m. At 8:53 p.m., the air raid sirens blared out because the German anti-aircraft was dead set on this fleet of 283 planes. They thought the... I missed my period there. Because the German anti-aircraft was dead set on this fleet of 283 planes, they thought the Würzburg group was a diversionary maneuver and left it totally unchecked. But the Nuremberg mission was a chance for the crippled German fighter weapon to prove its once-feared mettle one last time. In this war, 24 Lancasters were taken out, a loss rate of 8.7%. In contrast to the No. 5 group in Würzburg, in Nuremberg, the remaining planes encountered a city that was definitely not untouched. They worked their way through the city and finished off the destruction started the previous January 2nd and February 20th. On April 5th, the U.S. 3rd Division would pour down another 1,000 tons of bombs. On Würzburg Day, March 16th, housing blocks were set on fire in Nuremberg South City, in Steinbrühl, Gostenhof, and Galgenhof. Not only were 517 lives taken, but fires were raised in the Opera House and the Germanic National Museum. The only historic building destroyed was St. Clara's, the early Gothic church built in 1270 at the northeastern corner of the convent of the Order of St. Magdalena. At that time, the two parts of the settlement were not yet connected, the Reichsburg Fortress and the Imperial Palace in the north with its estate officials and servants, and the quarters of the artisans and merchants south of the swampy Pegnitz River. Not until 1320 did the Heckersteg Hangman's Bridge connect the two worlds. In the Third Reich, they were again separated, the Nuremberg of the Nazi Party rallies, its own entity, distant from the city of the people that opened up to the history of Germany like a window. I'm skipping about a page and a half here, and then I'm going to continue about Nuremberg. The crews were instructed to fly the first major raid of the night of August 28, 1942. We're going back in time to the kind of when the bombing first started in Nuremberg. They were instructed to fly as low as possible. The Pathfinders dropped accurate markings with still new illuminating bombs, but the munitions fell scattered as far as Erlangen. In Nuremberg, the original windows of the Albrecht Dürer house shattered. The roof of the castle flew off, and a direct hit crushed the castle gardener's house. In a brilliant attack with planes dropping almost to ground level, the Nazi rally grounds were bombed. The mission's loss rate was 14.5%. One-third of the planes reached the intended city. Southern Germany caused aggravation for Bomber Command all the way up to the Black Night, when the force lost 95 planes from a fleet of 795. I believe that's the night we're talking about. The largest number that England has ever flown against Nuremberg. In theory, the bombing objective was the main freight train depot, and the creep-back effect, that involuntary tendency for each successive bomb drop to be progressively shorter of the declared target, had been incorporated into the calculations. Based on those calculations, the city center would be directly below the bomb base. The bomber stream, over 70 miles long, would need 17 minutes to pass over Nuremberg and destroy it. Now, again, remember, we're back in 1942 here in August. At 11:22 p.m., they reached the Schelde River. Lying ahead of the attackers were 420 miles of enemy airspace. With the tailwind, it would take 103 minutes. The Germans had detected the approach over the North Sea and were circling in a holding pattern under a shining half moon. The British were startled to discover the enemy so early along the route. On top of that, the treacherous weather caused each plane to leave a contrail. Flight Lieutenant D.F. Gillam of 100 Squadron climbed to 22,000 feet in his Halifax and looked down regretfully at the weighed-down Lancaster comrades flying about 2,000 feet below him. He decided against a dogfight with the German fighters. With their bombs on board, the entire force was too ponderous to pick a fight. They dropped their incendiary and high-explosive bombs, hoping to hit the right city in the right place and that the night sky would let them get away undiscovered. I think this Lieutenant Gillam said afterwards, "I watched fascinated as a twin-engine German type overtook him, approaching," well, he was looking at a particular plane, "approaching just under the contrail. The German got underneath the Lancaster and fired straight into his belly with an upward-firing gun. The bomber took no evasive action at all. There was an explosion, and it blew clean in half. My stomach turned over, and we tried to get even higher." One Halifax, unable to climb to a higher altitude, dumped its load, turned, and headed home. A Pathfinder that could not get above 14,000 feet pressed on, with bombers crashing down past it, like a blazing inferno, some too close for comfort, he said. The last 82 were shot down approaching Nuremberg. Bomber Command lost 545 men in this mission. Those who managed to make it through to Franconia were so miserable that one in six mistakenly attacked Schweinfurt, 45 miles northwest of Nuremberg, and another group bombed the rural districts east of there. The village of Schönberg, buried away in the forest, was marked and burned down. Livestock raced around the pastures as if mad. Burnt pig cadavers littered the farmyards. Fowl flew the coop, and the residents stood grimacing before their destroyed homes, the women sobbing helplessly. The fiasco of Bomber Command's Black Night marked the abandonment of all remaining hope that Germany could be forced from the air to capitulate. For the present, the British had had enough of Nuremberg. The U.S. 8th Air Force, however, appeared midday on October 3, 1944, with 454 flying fortresses. They hit the choir of St. Sebald's Church, the castle, the Dürer House, and landed a direct hit on the Peller House behind it, which had been among Germany's most beautiful patrician residences. The bombs plowed through the 400-year-old St. Roch's Cemetery, slinging around the sarcophagus like sandstone monuments, uncovering the resting bones. Bomber Command returned on January 2, 1945, guided by oboe transmitters in France, with 2,300 tons of bombs on board. The drops covered the city center with a concentration of more than 15 tons per acre. After 53 minutes, old Nuremberg was rubble. The Tucker Castle, the Hans Sachs and Weitstoss houses, the Holy Ghost, the Aegidius's and Master Singer's churches, the entire castle grounds, and a total of 2,000 medieval homes were crushed in a vandalistic fit of raving madness. But perhaps that impression is deceiving. Historic shrines such as Hildesheim, Magdeburg, Dresden, Würzburg, and Nuremberg, which had all remained intact throughout much of the war as they were militarily irrelevant, were destroyed in series during the last 3 months of the war. To all appearances, that is the work of reason. Were not these cities the great symbols demonstrating to the German people their background? Their past was made of these imperial palaces and offices, workshops and royal residences, cathedrals and markets, cloisters and alleyways, universities and hospitals, bridges and dams. They all existed long before any German state had existed. To assure, I'm skipping a couple sentences, to assure that none of that remained, the rubble was pounded twice more by the Americans and once more by the British. A total of 6,369 people left their lives under 13,807 tons of bombs in Nuremberg. After the January raid, hordes of rucksack-carrying 12-year-olds who had been evacuated to a children's camp in Kinding in the Upper Palatinate returned to the city to look for their parents. Despite the winter cold, people threw away shoes and clothing they thought had come in contact with phosphorus, fearing they would burn to death. Curiosity drew people from the countryside to have a look at the damage. Many refused to leave the bunkers. When the city was conquered in April, they were still sitting there. Air and water supplies had broken down. Dr. Kurt Bingold, who had been persecuted by the Nazis, became director of the municipal hospital once the occupation began. He had the bunker rats taken out. He said, "We were in the Tucher bunker. Everyone was," or someone said, "we were in the Tucher bunker. Everyone was sleeping, whether sitting, lying down, or standing. That night there was a calmness, nothing short of eerie." Well, I've still got 8 minutes. I'm going to read this paragraph, and then I'm going to move on to... maybe I'll just go on to Munich. So I will be able to read about Munich after all. Now, Munich had been bombed since 1942. I'm on page 287 now, listeners. Munich had been bombed since 1942, and much damage had been done. But now, we're reading, in July 1944, the U.S. Air Force pounced on Munich with a million incendiaries in 7 raids. The first 4 killed 1,471 people. Private funerals were no longer possible because of a coffin shortage. The corpses or parts of them were given identifying markings and buried in mass graves in the North Cemetery and the Perlach Forest. The Americans made extensive use of time delay fuses in the July attacks. The bombs penetrated the apartment buildings and got caught in the ceilings between the stories. For days on end, they continued to explode day and night with a deafening bang, toppling walls and killing residents in their sleep. Household effects that could be saved were lying around on the streets, bundled up blankets, chests of drawers from former days, heirloom paintings that had been passed down for generations. Old women crying to themselves watched over the junk. At the Victory Gate, Hausenstein noted, now this is a person who he's talked to who's from Munich, but I didn't get the whole story as earlier. I didn't go back and, I couldn't find it. So anyway, this fellow Hausenstein is mentioned a few times. He noted a bronze lion was left standing on its head for over a month. The city's ruination was so radical that people could not grasp it, even though it was staring them in the face. Now, Hausenstein says, people think they are wandering through an absurd dream. The Frauenkirche, St. Michael's, and the Tietner Church are still standing, thank God. The streets are totally dead. The population seems to have melted down to a third or a quarter of what it was in one blow. Gruff girls, in a new manner, seemingly whore-like, who are apparently indifferent to what has happened, go about their business. Continuing with Friedrich, from September to October, the Americans added another 12 raids. Damage to the sewer, how many raids can you do? Damage to the sewer system, not to mention the garbage that could not be removed due to all the rubble, made Munich dirty, joyless, and intimidated. On November 22nd, the Americans landed a direct hit on the high altar of the Frauenkirche, St. Michael's, the largest and most renowned Renaissance church north of the Alps, suffered multiple hits in the barrel vault, and the Damensiftkirche, the convent church of St. Anna, was devastated. On the third Sunday of Advent, now we're in 45, Bomber Command dropped 4 tons of aerial mines and 80,000 incendiary bombs onto Munich city center after having given the city a break from the 19th to the 40th air raid. A bit further away, the Neue Pinakothek Art Museum and the Glyptothek Antique Sculpture Museum, the Maximilianium, he calls it, Parliament Building, Market Hall, two cemeteries, the Brown House, which was, you know, the Nazi headquarters, the State Opera, the grounds of the SS Reich leadership, and the Krone Circus were all leveled. The city is in such a wretched state, Hausenstein recorded, that it is impossible to mention each detail. This was only the 42nd of 73 attacks. After the 44th raid, which sent down 1,040 high-explosive bombs and 400,000 incendiary sticks and killed 505 people, Hausenstein wandered around the snow-covered city for 3 hours. It was January 19, 1945. The destruction was absolute. Some building facades were still standing. Cracked shells that would fall within the next two or three attacks. How could the future even begin to build upon such a ruin? Well, I made good time tonight, so I've got some more. I've got this marked. That's Stuttgart. Okay, I will continue here. What's his name? Stein. Can't find his name. Hausenstein. It's broken up with between two lines. Hausenstein wrote or said in an interview, assuming the monumental buildings and the best apartment buildings, which share the monumentality and are so necessary to it as the air, as the active element of continuity, without which a city is nothing. So assuming that all these pieces could theoretically be restored, it remains inconceivable that such an endeavor would be feasible. There was no money to finance a project of such magnitude, since ultimately it would mean recreating the work of 800 years, at least in its main aspects. This underscores how reasonable the war contribution in former wars actually was. Gustavus Adolphus ruined the city only financially, a method beneficial for both sides. Rebuilding 8 centuries, however, surpasses the already unsurpassable question of cost, because the mere idea of even wanting to do this probably already seems absurd. Perhaps individual pieces which served as an anchor for the city could be prepared in order barely to suggest the tradition in this way. Maybe the Frauenkirche, if her vaults could withstand the wetness, the snow, and the frost, the Tietner Church, part of the residence palace, maybe the state library, or maybe the Alte Pinakothek. But heaven knows if it will even be possible to pose these questions at all 1 or 2 months down the line. In the February raids by the American forces, the Frauenkirche suffered another hit. All of the vaults of the principal nave and aisles up to the abutment collapsed. It was partially replicated, as was the Tietner Church. Munich lost 6,632 people including 435 children, from its total population of 835,000. I'm going to stop there because we're almost up to the break. And I will say, when I was in Munich, I thought it looked a little artificial. I know people love Munich, but some of these famous buildings just didn't look quite like as if they were old. You know, they just didn't. To me, maybe it always looked that way, but something seemed to be kind of wrong with it. And then it spoke in Nuremberg about the St. Sebald's Church. There are so many wonderful churches, and in Nuremberg, St. Sebald's was the one that I liked the best because it had a lot of exhibits about the destruction, and it still wasn't rebuilt yet. It was just partially. You could see a lot of the destruction still there. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to this. And when I get back, I'll continue with.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Spain has plunged into a second recession amid government measures to rein in the country's debt. Ratings agency Standard & Poor's has downgraded 9 of Spain's banks, many of which are bogged down in bad loans. It also comes as Spain's unemployment rate has soared to almost 25%, the highest in Europe. And sweeping cuts to healthcare and education have seen thousands taken to the streets, angered at the government austerity measures. Let's get some analysis on the situation in the country from Professor of Economics, Philip Bagus. He's also the author of the book, The Tragedy of the Euro, joining me there in Spain. So the country is the Eurozone's fourth largest economy. It's in recession now for the second time in just 3 years. Today, as I've just said, we've seen 9 of its banks downgraded. What are the wider implications here? What danger could that pose to financial institutions in its European neighbours?
Well, of course, the Spanish banks are in a very bad position, and if they fail, this will of course directly affect other European banks, but it will also affect the Spanish government that will try to bail these Spanish banks out, and the Spanish government is not in a good healthy position either. So then the Spanish government might not be able to bail out their banks. It might default, and this default indirectly will affect of course the European banking system and the ECB.
So what about bailing out the entire Spanish economy? That has been talked about, but I've spoken to some analysts who say it's simply too big to bail out.
It might be, but at the end they can print all the money they want just to bail out Spain. The question is if politically it's possible to do that. Probably not, so it might be impossible to bail out Spain.
Politically, what within the wider Eurozone and also within the country itself, talking about the instability we're seeing there, the protests against the government cuts, politically, just how much could this government now suffer?
Yeah, this government is suffering because it's doing some small reforms, but actually it's not doing enough. They do some austerity for the public sector, but not enough. And you have to see that the austerity for the public sector means growth for the private sector.
Is austerity then the right way to go? Because many would say, of course, that does hamper growth, and that's exactly what Spain does need, is growth.
Yes, but it needs growth of the private sector, not of the public sector. So if you reduce government spending, you give the private sector more space to breathe, to grow. Of course, the error that the Spanish government is doing is to increase taxes, which is the opposite of austerity for the public sector, and which hampers the development of the private sector. So austerity for the public sector is the right way to go for growth of the private
sector. But that is so.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners, to tonight's program, The Death and Political Testament of Adolf Hitler. In this half hour, I'm going to give you a brief description of the highlights of events in the Führer Bunker between April 20th, Hitler's 56th birthday, and April 30th, the day he chose for his death. I'm using mainly three sources, but with the inclusion of others, too. The three are Traudl Junge, Hitler's youngest secretary, a girl from Munich, and one of two who did not leave the bunker until May 1st. Her memoir is the earliest, completed in 1947. Traudl was denazified and came to believe that her boss was a, or at least she came to say outwardly later, that her boss was a Jekyll and Hyde who was nice to her and all his staff, but was a mass murderer of the Jews. And so she was a sort of, as she said, she was ashamed. She couldn't see that in the beginning, which she certainly did not. Next, Heinz Linge, who also remained in the bunker until May 1st, 2nd, and was Hitler's trusted valet and personal aide. His memoir was published in German in 1980, but not until 2009 in English. And third, Nikolaus von Below, a Prussian, Hitler's Luftwaffe adjutant, whose memoir is titled At Hitler's Side, which is where he was from 1937 until April 28, 1945, or April 29th. I have that wrong, because he did sign. He was one of the signers of the will and testament. I have also consulted Krista Schroeder, another secretary, and Hannah Reich, the test pilot, who is in the bunker from April 26th to April 30th, and, of course, Wikipedia, and David Irving, and a few other websites. We begin on Hitler's last birthday, April 20th. It was customary to celebrate Hitler's birthday. It wasn't something that he particularly cared about so much, but he went along with the desires of others. On this particular day, all of the top men of the Third Reich, who were anywhere nearby or could manage to fly or drive in, came to offer their birthday congratulations, which was what they always did. And they wanted to do so personally. Hitler was not in the mood on that day, and he didn't care at all about it. He would rather just let his birthday go by, it appeared. But they actually said in one place I read that they said they were going to stay there where they were until he came out of his room, you know, and they could shake hands with him. So he finally came out, and he did receive them. And then also the staff in the bunker wanted to be received and wish him, congratulate him on his birthday, which they always did. And so he allowed that too. And so he spent quite a bit of time receiving all these people. And then he spent that day in large part in his rooms with Eva, playing with his favorite puppy, Wolf. Everyone wanted him to leave Berlin. They had been talking to him about leaving Berlin. Going to Berchtesgaden, which had a lot of bunkers also, and go down to the south, the way, because they knew Berlin was under attack by the Russians, and they intended to take Berlin. But Hitler had made up his mind to stay, and he would not be moved. However, Nicholas von Below said he thought Hitler was still wavering about it on that day, April 20th. But Hitler did plan to send all the non-indispensable staff south to Munich, and especially Berchtesgaden. We can talk about Hitler's reasons for not leaving Berlin in the second hour when I have my guest on. Now, that day, still April 20th, Hitler's birthday, he did go out. I'm pretty sure it was that day. He did go out and pin medals on the Hitler Youth Boys also in the Reichschancellery Park. He did want to do that. And Ribbentrop also on that day tried to get Eva Braun. Ribbentrop was the foreign minister, and he went even further than just telling Hitler that he should leave Berlin and go south. But he tried to get Eva Braun to convince Hitler to leave Berlin, and she declined, telling him that it was Hitler's decision to make, and whatever decision he'd make, he made, she would go along with him and stay with him. Now, on April 22nd, there was an important military conference, in the Fuhrer bunker, and there was reported that there was agitated and loud voices coming from behind closed doors. There were generally military conferences, but this may have been about the last one in the bunker. And when the door opens, Traudl-Junga says that she saw that all the military men were bent over street maps of Berlin at the big table. And after they leave the room, Hitler calls his secretaries in and says, she said in a sort of different tone of voice than he ever used before, get changed at once. A plane is leaving in an hour and will take you south. All is lost, hopelessly lost. Ava Braun is also there. She goes to him, takes his hands, and says, but you know, I shall stay with you. I'm not letting you send me away. According to Junga, Hitler's eyes take on a shine from within. He kisses her on the mouth, something he has never done in front of others before. Traudl announced then at that moment that she was staying too. She says she doesn't know why, but she couldn't help herself. Some would have liked to have left, but they really couldn't because they were essential to being a part of Hitler's group there. And others did not want to. They couldn't imagine going anywhere else or being anywhere than in the company of those that they were with. So Hitler went out to the officers in the corridor and said, gentlemen, it's all over. I shall stay here in Berlin and shoot myself when the moment comes. Anyone who wants to go can go now. Everyone is free to do so. Hitler then shook hands with them all in turn, saying goodbye, and only the most important liaison officers stayed behind. One by one, they left, silently saluting the Führer, leaving Berlin, for the most part, forever. Now, during these days, I guess 21st, 22nd, and on, Hitler would spend time with his dogs. Sometimes he sat quietly with a puppy in his lap, out where others, in the common room. On April 23rd, Albert Speer visited Hitler, according to Heinz Linge. Junga remembered a day or two later. Junga thought it was a day or two later, but Linge said it was on the 23rd. But anyway, he did come and visit Hitler, and Bormann had asked Speer to try to change Hitler's mind about staying in Berlin. He did advise Hitler to leave Berlin. And actually, Bormann wanted to go south. Perhaps he would have survived. He liked it in the south. But, of course, he couldn't leave. So Speer came, and he left that late that night that he had arrived in the afternoon. And he didn't. That was the last he was seen. At this time, Hitler selected papers and documents to be destroyed from his personal cupboards, and Julia Schaub, who was his long-time old comrade from the beginning, was given the task. He's described as looking miserably unhappy. Schaub took them up to the park and burned them. Then he was sent to Munich and Berchtesgaden to do the same, which he did. He faithfully carried out that order. Some of the people who were left were Huell, Bormann, General Krebs, and General Bergdorf, Hermann Feigelin, Ava's brother-in-law, Admiral Voss, Adjutants von Bello, and Otto Gunche, who will be talked about later, and Heinz Lorenz, who was a press secretary, most of the domestic staff, switchboard, and chauffeurs. Now, the Goebbels family, with their six children, arrived to stay because now Berlin was being bombed and it wasn't safe. So they had wanted to come and stay with Hitler in the bunker. So they were put up in some bedrooms. Hitler did not want the children to come there to die, but Magda insisted, and Joseph seemed to want it too. They had agreed that that's what they would do. We can talk about that in the second hour also. Hitler wanted Minister Goebbels to be a part of the new government after his death, but actually he allowed everyone to do as they chose for themselves because he knew that the time had come when everyone was going to do what they wanted for themselves. You know, I mean, getting close. Still, he was still very much in control and command, but, you know, he realized what the situation was. Goebbels had brought his state secretary, Dr. Naumann, and his adjutant, Schwagerman, with him, and they discussed what to tell the German people. They're still putting out radio messages. Himmler called then around that time and tried to get Hitler to leave the city, and Hitler was not pleased about that. He didn't like these high staff trying to tell him what to do, you know, and make this decision for him. And so this kind of put him in a bad mood with Himmler. Now, the children are said to have been playing happily in the corridors. They were completely trusting and oblivious of being in any danger right up to the end. They could hear the firing and the bombs and stuff, but they thought they were safe with Uncle Führer, which is what they called him, and that everything would be all right. And everybody says that they didn't show any signs of stress or concern. And they didn't know that they were going to die. Their mother made sure of that. And by all reports, they were exceptionally happy and well-behaved children who got along together and played together and, you know, did things together, and which they continued doing. Hitler suddenly feared his Dr. Morell, the doctor that he liked so much, who gave him preparations of his own making that allowed Hitler to function at a better level than he would otherwise. But he suddenly became suspicious of Morell, thinking he was going to anesthetize him so that they could ferret him out of Berlin and send him away. He was a little worried about that, obviously, that they had some plan, maybe. His own people had some plan to abscond him out of there, and he really didn't want to be, you know, he didn't want to leave. Now, Arthur Axman, who was very strong National Socialist, he was the new youth leader, and I don't know how new he was, but he had taken over from von Schirach, and he arrived to stay with his Führer. He wanted to be there. Then Albert, according to Junge, Albert Speer appeared now, but had a long conversation with Hitler and left that evening. Okay, then Göring's treachery came to light, which we will discuss later, which is referenced in the Political Testament. I think it was a bit, I think he is misunderstood, but anyway, that's that. Now, on April 26th, Hannah Reich and the wounded General Ritter von Greim arrived late in the afternoon, flying in a Fiesler Storch. Greim is taken directly into the hospital for surgery because he had a bad leg wound because the plane was hit on their way in. They remain until the two of them remain until very early April 30th, like 1 a.m. So they weren't there for the part of the day when all that was taking place. But Reich has said, and Junge also said, that they spent time entertaining the Goebbels children, the Goebbels children. Their mother, Junge says, their mother hardly had the strength to face her children with composure now. Every meeting with them made her feel so terrible, she burst into tears afterwards. And then they were cut off from the outside world on April 26th. All they had left was a wireless telephone connection to Field Marshal Keitel. And the Russians had reached the Tiergarten. Now, the Tiergarten is right there in the political center of Berlin, very close to the Reichschancellery, where they were down in the bunker. And, you know, right one end of it has the Reichstag. You know, they're right there. And Feiglin, Eva's brother-in-law and friend, which... I don't have time to go into all that story right now, but he had not been seen for several days. And so on the 27th, the security service goes out to hunt for him, and he's found. They very seldom fail to find what they're looking for. And he's found in his apartment in Munich, I think it was, but somewhere down south. And he's arrested, and he's wearing civilian clothes, and they arrested him and brought him back. After that, Linge reports that Hitler calls him in, Linge being Hitler's personal aide, always around him, the only one who can go in and out of his room, basically, without permission. I mean, he knocks, you know, but, I mean, he's the one that takes care of everything in there. He says Hitler calls him in, or he's in there, and Hitler says to him, first he says that he's releasing him to his family. And when, you know, that he can go and go down south where his family is. And Linge refuses to leave, says, I will not leave you after I've been with you so long. I'm going to have to, I think, well, I hope I'll make everything here. Hitler then tells him to, since he said he's going to stay, to hold in readiness woolen blankets in my bedroom and enough petrol for two cremations. I am going to shoot myself here together with Eva Braun. You will wrap our bodies in woolen blankets, carry them up to the garden, and there burn them. Linge says he was speechless. He didn't say a word. He finally left the room. He told Kempka, Hitler's driver, to place some petrol canisters near the bunker entrance. And that night they have a birthday party for Rattenhuber, who is head of Hitler's personal security guard. He's 60, and it's his birthday. And he is a Munich-born, as so many of those who were with Hitler from right in the beginning, as he was, early on anyway. And he remarks during the party with Mary, while they're joking and so on, with Mary but damp eyes, that he is going to die, quote, among Prussians of all things, unquote. I mentioned that because I thought that was both cute and touching and sad and so on. He was making it just kind of a joke, but it was heartfelt. That night or the next, the kitchen maid and a driver had a wedding. Now, on April 28th, I have run out of time here because I want to read the political testament. It takes about 10 minutes. So they found out about Himmler, and Feiglin was shot, was condemned to death and shot in the park. And Hitler now distrusted the poison capsules that had been distributed by Himmler to him and others. So to make sure that it was effective, he called in Dr. Haas, and he went in to where Blondie, Hitler's beloved dog, was, and she had had puppies, you know, gave her one of those capsules, and she became instantly immobile. Hitler returned to the group, his face like a death mask, and shut himself in his room. Now, you know, this would have had to have been done eventually anyway, in a day or two, because they had to put the dogs to sleep so they wouldn't be harmed and tortured and bombed and, you know, left to run around when everybody left. So now Goebbels makes a little speech. Now is when Trudel Junge goes on April 29th. She has she spends some time sleeping, and then she comes to the Führer study for tea. They still had tea every day. And the table is set for a party with champagne glasses. And Hitler asks her, you know, if she had slept well. And then he tells her he wants her to take down some dictation. So the two of them go into the conference room. And he says to her, take it down on your shorthand pad. And she sits at the conference table. He stands in his usual place, according to her. She was the only one there. Leans both hands on the table and stares at the empty tabletop, which means he had no notes. I don't know if he did. I think he had to have some notes, but apparently she's saying that he was just, you know, he was just dictating from out of his mind. He utters the first words, my political testament. When he finishes that, he pauses for a brief moment and then begins dictating his private will. Well, I am going to read the political testament. I might skip a couple paragraphs here and there because I want to finish it before the end of this section. Here's how he started it, without notes. More than 30 years have now passed since I, in 1914, made my modest contribution as a volunteer in the First World War that was forced upon the Reich. In these three decades, I have been actuated solely by love and loyalty to my people in all my thoughts, acts, and life. They gave me the strength to make the most difficult decisions which have ever confronted mortal man. I have spent my time, my working strength, and my health in these three decades. It is untrue that I or anyone else in Germany wanted the war in 1939. It was desired and instigated exclusively by those international statesmen who were either of Jewish descent or worked for Jewish interests. I have made too many offers for the control and limitation of armaments, which posterity will not for all time be able to disregard, for the responsibility of the outbreak of this war to be laid on me. I have further never wished that after the first fatal world war, a second against England or even against America should break out. Centuries will pass away, but out of the ruins of our towns and monuments, the hatred against those finally responsible, whom we have to thank for everything, international Jewry and its helpers, will grow. 3 days before the outbreak of the German-Polish War, I again proposed to the British ambassador in Berlin a solution to the German-Polish problem, similar to that in the case of the Saar district under international control. This offer also cannot be denied. It was only rejected because the leading circles in English politics wanted the war, partly on account of the business hoped for and partly under influence of propaganda organized by international Jewry. I have also made it quite plain that if the nations of Europe are again to be regarded as mere shares to be bought and sold by these international conspirators in money and finance, then that race, Jewry, which is the real criminal of this murderous struggle, will be saddled with responsibility. I further left no one in doubt that this time not only would millions of children of Europe's Aryan peoples die of hunger, not only would millions of grown men suffer death, and not only hundreds of thousands of women and children be burnt and bombed to death in the towns without the real criminal having to atone for his guilt, even if by more humane means. After 6 years of war, which in spite of all setbacks will go down one day in history as the most glorious and valiant demonstration of our nation's purpose, of a nation's purpose, I cannot forsake the city which is the capital of this empire. Excuse me. As the forces are too small to make any further stand against the enemy attack at this place, and our resistance is gradually being weakened by men who are as deluded as they are lacking in initiative, I should like, by remaining in this town, to share my fate with those, the millions of others, who have also taken upon themselves to do so. Moreover, I do not wish to fall into the hands of an enemy who requires a new spectacle organized by Jews for the amusement of their hysterical masses. I have decided, therefore, to remain in Berlin, and there, of my own free will, to choose death at the moment when I believe the position of the Führer and Chancellor itself can no longer be held. He says he dies with a happy heart and aware of the great deeds and achievements of the men and women, soldiers and the men and women at home, or the women at home, the farmers, the workers, and then he says, unique in history of our youth who bear my name. And he wishes thanks them all, from all those from the bottom of his heart. He says that he wishes that they should on no account give up the struggle, but rather continue it against the enemies of the fatherland, no matter where, true to the creed of a great Clausewitz. From the sacrifice of our soldiers and from my own unity with them unto death, will in any case spring up in the history of Germany the seed of a radiant renaissance of the National Socialist Movement, and thus the realization of a true community of nations. He speaks about the courageous men of the military. He speaks about the code of honor of the German officers, that surrender is not possible, that they should fulfill their duty unto death. And then the second part of the testament, he talks about Hermann Göring and expels him from the party. He expels Heinrich Himmler from the party, and he appoints General Dönitz to take the place of the President of the Reich and Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, and he appoints Gauleiter Karl Hanke as Reichsführer SS and Chief of the German Police, and Gauleiter Paul Giesler as Reich Minister of the Interior, and he gives some more. He goes through a list of those. But I want to be sure I read the last sentence then, after he gives all these instructions to who's going to be in charge of what, and he, you know, hopes that there can be a government. He says, above all, I charge the leaders of the nation and those under them to scrupulous observance of the laws of race and to merciless opposition to the universal poisoner of all peoples, international jewelry. And this was dictated and signed in triplicate. It was written in triplicate, signed and sent out to the world on the 29th day of April, and it was signed at 4 a.m. And after that, they had the wedding party. I will continue. We'll continue talking about that, the wedding and the suicide, when we get back for the second hour. Stay with me, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks.
Where is Mr. Chen Guangcheng?
Where is he?
Mm-hmm.
I have nothing for you on that subject.
State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland remaining tight-lipped on the case of Chinese activist Chen Guangcheng, who is reported to be receiving U.S. diplomatic protection in Beijing after escaping from house arrest. President Obama also refused to discuss the case publicly, but he did tell reporters at the White House that China will be stronger when it liberalizes. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Daniel Wrenches reports.
Assistant Secretary of State Kurt Campbell has been in Beijing since Sunday in an effort to contain a sensitive diplomatic dispute over dissident Chen Guangcheng, though President Obama's refused to comment.
Obviously, I'm aware of the press reports on the situation in China, but I'm not going to make a statement on the issue.
Mr. Chen's escape presents a challenge to diplomats just before scheduled meetings in Beijing with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner later this week.
Mr. Chen's supporters say they believe behind the scenes a deal is taking shape that will secure his departure with his family from mainland China. Bob Fu of Texas-based China Aid told FSN the case could be resolved very soon.
There could be a decision or a formal response for Chen's resettlement or a solution very soon.
When you say Mr. Chen's resettlement, does that imply that he might leave the country?
I think that is the most viable solution so far.
British Prime Minister David Cameron has again ruled out a new inquiry into whether his culture secretary acted improperly over media mogul Rupert Murdoch's bid to buy broadcaster B Sky B. The opposition Labour Party wants an inquiry into whether Jeremy Hunt broke the country's ministerial code in dealings between his office and News Corp. Prime Minister Cameron told the British Parliament that his opponents have misjudged the scandal.
I'm not belittling this issue, but it's not as serious as the Eurozone, the jobs, the investment, the debt that we have to deal with. It is time we focused on that.
More than a decade after Al-Qaeda launched its terror attacks on New York and Washington, the new World Trade Center has become the Big Apple's tallest building. From FSN's Bureau in New York, Li Ling Tan reports.
Also known as Freedom Tower, the structure is taking the title of tallest building in Manhattan from the iconic Empire State Building. And it won't stop there. Freedom Tower will continue to inch skyward to an estimated 1,776 feet when completed. By early 2014, its climb will position it as the tallest building in the United States and the third tallest in the world.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. The program tonight is the death and political testament of Adolf Hitler, which his death took place on April 30th, which today is the anniversary of that date. I want to tell you that we will be taking calls in this hour at 1-855-477-2283. But please hold off for at least 20 minutes or so before you try to call in, and so I can talk with my guest and let him speak. And so right now it's my pleasure to introduce Severus, who is, well, I've talked about him a little in the beginning, so I'll just say hello, Severus.
Oh, hello, and thank you, Carolyn, for having me. It's an honor. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for being here, and I'm sure you're going to have a lot of interesting things to say. I'm going to continue just a little bit, and then you break in whenever you want to. I might ask you if you have any comment, because okay. I didn't quite finish all of this. Yeah, we'll do this together. So now Hitler has dictated his political testament, and he goes back into the room with where the wedding party is taking place, but they're not married yet. Now, Traudl Junge, who took the dictation for this, she now has to type it up. So she goes into Goebbels' room next to his room, and where there's a typewriter, and she starts typing there, because the conference room that they were in is now being set up as a registry office. And then the Hitler and Eva are married and sign the documents and so on. And Eva is very happy about this, but I don't want to get into all this woman-y stuff. But it's kind of fun. I like to think about it. But she is very happy. But I also have to say that during this time, I'm not during the wedding party, but at some point, I read that all the dogs have been shot by the dog walker. That was his job, and he had to do it so that they wouldn't be torn to pieces by grenades or bombs. And Magda Goebbels has also told her children that they may all have to be inoculated against disease, since there are so many people living together in close quarters in the bunker. And they understand that and accept that, because they're going to be getting a shot, an inoculation soon, but not yet. Okay, April... April 30th. Oh, I've already. Okay, it's the wedding's over. They're married and everything. And now April 30th is the day of the suicide. And Lingus says that they have a midday meal all together. You know, all the people. They all were together. I mean, the secretaries were included in everything. They were like family, and they took their meals together. Nobody was left out. You know, although there were people working in other sections who weren't a part of this close inner group. But anyway, after the meal, according to Linga, Eva Hitler thanks Linga for his service and all he has done for the Fuhrer. See, they're getting prepared for their suicide. And Eva had bequeathed earlier her silver fox coat to Traudl, which Traudl said it made her strangely happy. She was real pleased about it, but in the end she wasn't able to take it with her. Magda Goebbels has requested a last meeting with Hitler. Linga says that when he entered the room, Hitler was thanking her for her commitment and services, and he asked Linga to pin Hitler's gold party badge on Magda in special recognition. And it was about 15 hours. Linga asked for his orders from Hitler. He says, outwardly calm and in a quiet voice, Hitler said, Linga, I'm going to shoot myself now. You know what you have to do. Attach yourself to one of the breakout groups and try to get through to the West. Linga asked what we should fight for now. He kind of got bold here at the end, and so he asked Hitler this question. And Hitler answers, for the coming man. That's what Linga said, reported. Linga saluted him. Hitler comes toward him and offers his hand, then raises his right arm in the Hitler salute. And that was the last, that was their last meeting. Now, according to Junge, she says that she and the other ladies returned to their room from lunch, and then in a little while, Otto Günsche comes to tell the secretaries that he is one of Hitler's personal aides, an SS officer. He's been with Hitler for a long time, too, and he's also from down south. He comes to tell the secretaries, the Fuhrer wants to tell them goodbye, and she says that they went into the corridor outside Hitler's room where a lot of others were gathered, or some of the others were gathered, and Hitler came out and shook hands with them all. She says, I feel his right hand warm in mine. He looks at me but seems far away. He says something, but I don't hear it. I didn't take in his last words. I am frozen. Then Ava Brown comes over to me, smiles and embraces me, says, please do try to get out. You may yet make your way. I'm getting into too much of this sentimental stuff. I'm going to stop. She's wearing Hitler's favorite dress, and her hair is washed and shining. And then they go back into the room. Now, I've got the account of what happened by by both Traudl and Linge and Otto Gunsche. But you know how the suicide went. But do you have any comments on that so far? I really want to hear from you.
Not on the particular details of it, right? I mean, the details are pretty much what they are, right? I think that the most interesting aspect of all this would be to later on discuss the implications of that last testament, right? The psychological implications of it, whatever we can muster from it, and also discuss maybe the secretary, you know, you mentioned it at first, right? That she seems to have bought the propaganda on a later date. That, well, I mean, he seemed like a great person, but apparently he was not, type of thing. I think that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Although David Irving interviewed her, I forget now the date. I might have it down below here on my pages, but he interviewed her, and maybe around 1960 or so. And he said she was still very natural. And other people said that even though she said publicly what she said after a certain point in time, that Hitler was obviously a terrible man, and she didn't see it, she didn't know it, he was always nice to her and she fell for it and so on, that's not what she said privately. So, you know, so many of these people, they were probably pressured too, you know.
Yeah, they were bullied.
Yeah,
exactly.
to say what they were supposed to say, and they did. But her memoir, which she wrote right afterwards, is quite interesting and very natural. I really like it because it's so natural. And they say she was always a very natural person. We're going to read. Talk about the political testament in just a minute. Then I just do want to say, I'm trying to shorten it, that Junge says that she went up to play with the children. And then there was a sound of a loud shot, and Helmut, the boy, said that was a direct hit, thinking it was, you know, something from outside. And then she sends the children back to their room, and she takes a drink of Steinhager and sits there and says her watch said sometime after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And as she's sitting there, Otto Gunsche comes up with a strong smell of petrol, and he says that he's carried out the Fuhrer's last order. His body is burnt. And he goes back down to, and he's quite ashen and gaunt. And he goes back down then. He takes a drink, did I say that? And then he goes back down to make sure the bodies are burnt. And she said she went into Hitler's, she just got an impulse and went down into the rooms. She went into Hitler's empty room, and she sees, well, I won't say everything, but she sees blood on the blue-white upholstery where Hitler was sitting. And then when she hears footsteps, she leaves, and the men are coming back in there. And according to Otto Gunsche told her that a few seconds after the shot, Goebbels opened the door, and he and Goebbels went in. But Linge says that he smelled gunpowder. He doesn't mention hearing a shot. Then he went to Bormann in another room and signaled him, and he and Bormann went in there first. And they said that Hitler was shot in his right temple. Bormann didn't say anything, but Linge said that, and somebody else said it. And then the Russians say they have Hitler's skull, and it's got a hole that fits that. And so he did shoot himself in his temple. But Gunsche told Traudl that he had shot himself in the mouth, and his skull was shattered. And he wrapped his head in a blanket and Goebbels, Axman, and Kempka carried the corpse up the stairs, but Otto Gunche supposedly, in most accounts, did carry Eva's body upstairs, and then they did manage to burn them pretty good. They did burn for about 3 or 4 hours. So while they may not have been totally cremated, they were burnt pretty well. And there's that story, you know, all those stories about what happened. But they don't make any sense because as Crowell Junger says, where else could the Fuhrer be now anyway? She said no one could pretend to be as shaken as he was, as Gunche was, and certainly because he was such an uncomplicated, muscular young man, he wasn't, you know, he wouldn't be making up stories. Where else could the Fuhrer be now anyway? She said there was no car, no plane, nothing within reach, no secret underground passage leading out of this bunker to freedom. And Hitler couldn't even walk properly anymore, which he couldn't. He was kind of dragging one foot. But I do want to make clear that he was not the wreck, the total wreck that some want to make him out to be. He certainly, his health was shot, and he did say, when people would say you should go and do something more and show the German people that you're leading the troops, whatever, he said, you know, he just shook his head and he said, I can barely hold a pistol. He said, what good would I be? I can't do that now. And then he said that if he did go out there and something happened to him, if he got wounded, he said he didn't believe any of his men, any of the soldiers would shoot him, you know, would put his life at an end, which is what he would want. So, and he did not want to be captured, you know, smart about that. So the best thing is what he did. I do believe he made the very best decisions. So we can talk about that more, and maybe someone might call about some of those things. So let's go now to the political testament, which I read. And where would you like to start with that, Severus?
Well, first of all, I do find interesting. I mean, a lot of people are obsessed, somewhat obsessed with if Hitler survived, or didn't survive, or if he was captured, or didn't survive Argentina. You know, that is a question by a lot of people.
Okay, I'm having trouble hearing you. I don't know if it's you or me.
It's a pretty good case that isn't so. Just because it would basically take a lot of energy, a lot of. Let me see if. Can you hear me now? I can hear you.
Yeah, Mike thinks it's your connection. It's kind of coming and going. But go ahead. We'll see if it fixes itself.
Let me see if I could try again. Just stop me if you.
Well, you
can't
just.
Hear me well, okay.
Well, it's breaking. We hear some, and then it's staticky. I hate to waste time on this, but you might have to reboot. But let's go on until the break. Okay.
Okay. Basically, what I'm saying is that I do believe that what you just laid out right now is a good case for the fact that Hitler did die there and did not survive.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel that it's. It would require too much work and too much planning and too much conspiracy to achieve anything else. So I think it's unreasonable. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, he did not want to survive anymore, and he didn't want to go anywhere. I mean, and that makes perfect sense why he wouldn't.
Exactly. I mean, it's clearly spelled out in his document that it's in the best interest of Germany and in the best interest of the party that he's not captured. And also, he actually mentions his death as a motivator, right, for National Socialism to respring, to come back again, and to maybe even become a pan-European movement. And I think there's a lot of meaning in that. That's one of my favorite parts of his testament, is the fact that he visualizes his death as the new beginning of his own movement. And I think that's significant as well. And I think for that reason, it would have been somewhat of a self-betrayal to somehow try to escape or to somehow risk himself anyway, because he could have been captured escaping, right? And risk his own life and then be humiliated anyway, right? I mean, it's just too risky. So I'm with you that I believe this is exactly what happened. And I think that the result of it is it's somewhat what I think he envisioned. And of course, he talks about centuries. I hope that it's not centuries. It takes less than centuries to achieve his goal, correct?
Well, he also...
aspect of it interesting.
Yeah, and speaking of that, he also says, I'm looking for it, but I haven't found it. But he mentions that he will be with those who he has appointed, and you know, in spirit. And you know, he was a religious man, as has been brought out many times. And I'm sure he didn't believe that he was going to be obliterated. I think he did believe in our continuation, and so he knew he would be somewhere. And he would be united with those who are still working to carry out what he had worked so hard for.
I agree. And another issue of his testament is the fact of his lucidity, right? He seems very clear. He doesn't seem, he's obviously distraught, but it doesn't seem that he's somewhat, you know, depressed to a level of incomprehension or a level that he can communicate, that he can't verbalize how he feels, that... It's pretty clear that he knows what he's talking about. It's very clear that he's not a bitter. This document is not a bitter document, right? It doesn't seem to spew out in hatred, as a lot of people would like to visualize him. It's actually pretty open about the fact that he wished for peace and he did not want the war. And I think a person who's about to shoot himself and... wouldn't say these things unless they were legitimately his case. Do you understand that? There's no point in making a case anymore because his entire nation is crumbling around him. But he still goes out of his way to make the case that his purpose was to revitalize Europe and to defend his nation, but that his hand was pushed into war, and I think that's very significant as well.
Yes, and you know, he's mentioned Drury as the enemy and the perpetrator behind all this several times, and that's criticized that he couldn't get over his anti-Semitism. He still had to bring the Jews and bring up the Jews all the time. I don't see that way. I think that he was determined right to the end to hold to his principles and his beliefs, and that he knew that this was the real, they were the problem, and he wasn't going to you know, a lot of people think that because he was now going to die. And all this horrible war had gone on, and they like to think that he's responsible for some of it, or a large part of it. If not, of course, some people think he's responsible for all of it. But you know, those who have more understanding still would think, well, why doesn't he make some nice gestures? Why doesn't he take some blame? Why doesn't he spread the blame around? And we hear that Severus all the time in the white nationalist movement too. Just to bring that in compromise with people who don't think like you do, accept some of their views, or you know, or let. I don't see it that way. I think you have to hold to your very clear principles all the time, and that's what I see him doing here. And I'm also very glad that he mentioned race at the end, for all those people who want to say that he softened up over the years and he was much less of a racialist. At the end, but I don't think, you know, I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah, of course not. But a lot of people say that because they're trying to. The thing is, Hitler is such an interesting character that everyone wants to claim him. Even Jews claim him by saying he's a Jew, right? I mean, everyone wants to be part of Hitler in some way. And I think that's a testament to his character and also a testament to his personality. I mean, such an impressive personality that everyone wants to be attached to him somehow. And I think that's the reason that you hear these stories. That just people want to be close to him somehow. But again, I think that in his case, it is pretty clear that he has his convictions. But one thing that Hitler was very good at is he was a strategic thinker. He was not a fanatical ideologue, right? I mean, he was clear in Mein Kampf that you have to hold a position and then you have to make that position win, right? And kind of displace other positions. So it was not like he was soft, kind of like a egalitarian type of thinker. But at the same time, he was a strategist and he understood that a lot of times you had to work with people that were with you, but they were not necessarily 100% with you, without necessarily compromising who you are. And I think that balance is not easy to achieve, but he achieved it, and that's why he was successful.
Well, very good. I hear you just muting. But what would you say? Can you give an example of that? Do you have an example in mind?
Yes, I have a couple examples. One would be his dealings with Marxists, right? I mean, in the beginning of his movement, a lot of members of the National Socialist Movement were Marxists, right? I mean, that's how they started, at least.
And didn't they switch? I mean, they were Marxists.
No, that's what I mean. No, but that's what I mean. What yeah. I mean is that he did not see them. Exactly. He didn't say, oh, they're Marxists, so they're long gone. You know, forget them, right? He said, no, look, these guys have a basic idea of what is correct. In other words, they believe in the community. They believe in workers' rights. These things are fine, but they're being twisted by Jewish Marxism. Therefore, we have to approach them, we have to communicate with them, and we have to turn them to our side. But he openly discussed it. It's not like it was a hidden agenda. He openly spoke about Marxists and telling, look, Germans that are Marxists are not our enemies unless they really, their objective is really to destroy us, right? But a lot of them are well-meaning. They're just confused or they're manipulated,
yeah,
right?
Well, I agree with you. I'm glad this came out because in Germany then, workers did have a bad situation, and so our workers' rights and labor unions and so on were a big issue. And there, all these workers had turned to the socialists, I guess. They didn't call them communists right off the bat, but you know, they had turned to that and to Marxism, and so the National Socialists made a big effort to actually get these
yeah.
people
so
and turn
yeah.
them yeah and they and that was where how they grew their strength. They got all these labor union people to go from communism
exactly.
to
yeah.
National Socialism, because they had a program for the workers too. And
not only that, but remember that the National Socialist Party itself had its own wings, right? Ideological wings. A lot of people
mm-hmm.
dismiss this, but this is actually important because it actually exemplifies that National Socialism had different wings within it, had different perspectives or different extremes, if you would, right? It had different wings, and Hitler was very good at balancing these wings and making them work, because it was not only Marxists. He also had people that he originally didn't care for, like the conservatives, right? What you would call conservatives at that time. He didn't necessarily think they were the best people in the world for the movement, just like he didn't feel the same about Marxists. But in the end, he made a lot of these variations in the movement work within, and obviously he was the center, right? He was like the center of gravity in that sense. And I presume that if he wasn't around, that probably wouldn't have worked and would have splintered into groups. But he was really good at making these disparate movements and people work. And I think that's the key. And I think another example would be also a lot of spiritual virtues also in the movement. You had some people that were more to one side than the other, and he made them work as well. And I think those are good examples, for example, of what I mean. He was good at strategizing and working and making people work together without compromising his ideals.
Yes, and you know, there was a socialist, definitely the socialist wing, who were more socialist than nationalist, actually. And then there were the nationalists, more nationalist than socialist. But Hitler has
exactly.
been accused of betraying the socialists and betraying the workers. There's a whole group, and they have names and so on, who say that, like to bring that up and accuse him of that. But he was uniting Germany, and he was determined to, like you just said, not to close off any part of it and to bring everyone together. And he did do that, and it was functioning so well until they forced war on him.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
and
it was functioning beautifully. And everybody was happy. Well, there's always a few people that aren't happy, I guess, but, you know, basically,
well,
most everyone was happy.
The reason that the Führer principle, right, the leadership principle worked
mm-hmm.
in their case is because he was the center of gravity. And if you focus in a movement like that, then you can make different people kind of work together to the same ends. I believe that the more radical leftists in the party were more upset about the revolutionary aspect of the party. In other words, they wanted more revolution, more, you know, breaking down systems, creating new things, positioning themselves in positions of power and of influence. And I think this always will happen in every movement. It's inevitable, right? It's part of our nature, the competitive nature, right? But nonetheless, he made it work. And of course, like you said, nothing is perfect, but he did make a lot of his people work together and achieve things. And I would even argue that a lot of his main circle, I mean, you read a lot of Goebbels' diaries. I mean, he didn't necessarily get along with everybody, right? I mean, there was always an issue. Heydrich had issues with Himmler. Himmler had issues with Heydrich. I mean, these things happen, and this is natural, is my point. So.
Oh, I didn't watch, and the time has come. We're at the break point, so we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, in a few minutes.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
French voters are beginning the process of choosing the next president. Now, there are 10 candidates in the running, including incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy and his main rival socialist, François Hollande. The main concern, though, is turnout will be low, all amid discontent over a struggling economy and record unemployment. Let's get the full picture now from RT's Tessa Arcilia, standing by for us live in Paris. So good to see you, Tessa. How is the voting going so far?
Well, it is underway, and as you mentioned, the voter turnout is a big concern here. I mean, people are watching it closely because the numbers could sway the results of round one of this presidential race. We've got early numbers, according to the Ministry of the Interior, about 28% have turned out so far. It's not that bad, but we have to wait for the total because the projection is that up to a third of voters won't actually cast their ballots, and that's because many of the French feel that there really isn't much of a choice. There's no one out there who's giving them real solutions to the problems they're facing, especially with regard to the economy and jobs. And this very disillusionment has given rise to more extreme views, feelings of anti-globalization or anti-immigration, which has also propped up candidates on the far right, such as Marine Le Pen, and on the left, you have Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Well, let's get a bit more insight on exactly what is happening here in France from Barry Lando. He's a journalist and author. Mr. Lando, thanks very much for joining us today. I brought up the issue of the far right and the hard left. Now, this feeling of anti-globalization. Is this a knee-jerk reaction to the problems, or is it here to stay?
No, I think it's here to stay for several years, and I think it's been here for quite a few years also. I think you're finding it all over Europe, and it's a puzzlement among the French. They can't quite figure out what's happened. They've been hard hit, like many other countries in Europe have been, and they're looking for a solution, sort of desperately. And unfortunately, the solutions are not going to be easy. So the parties on the right, on the left, the extreme parties are offering much more easy solutions, much more easy targets that people would like to believe in. But as far as the number of abstentions go, one point I think is fascinating is that in the United States, about 50% of the electorate does not vote. That's even in the year when Obama won, 50% didn't vote. So it's not just in France, it's in a lot of countries.
Okay, let's talk about the far right a little bit here, the sentiment of anti-immigration. It has been aligned for a long time, but Nicolas Sarkozy, who's on the center right, has been jumping on this bandwagon. What is this electioneering, or is it a problem that should be given a bit more significance in the country?
It's a problem that should have been given much more importance for the last 10 or 15 years. It's not at all new, and it's true Sarkozy has jumped on the bandwagon now. He's trying to get votes from the far left, from Marine Le Pen, who, of course, has always had that issue going. But yes, our
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're in the last half hour of our program on the death of Adolf Hitler and his political testament. My guest is Severus, who is also known... Severus, real quick now, tell us how you pronounce that name, Nifilson.
I usually pronounce it Nifilson. It comes from Niflheim, which is a Norse myth. It basically means the land of mist. Nifilson would be the son of mist, right? And I have a blog. The blog is nifilson.blogspot.com. And Nifilson is N-I-F-L-S-O-N. And it'll be easy to find. Just put nifilson.blogspot.com and you'll find it.
Very good. Thank you. I just thought Nifilson was something you made up. Can you believe that? I didn't look for it.
I haven't seen it around. I mean, Niflheim exists, but I've never seen Nifilson. But, I mean, it makes sense, so I put it together and created it.
Oh, I see. So you did, create it. All right. Well, all right. Good. I'm glad you told people how to get to your blog. Now, let's talk a little bit about Hitler's anger at Goering and Himmler, how justified it was, and were they justified in what they did? I'll just read this part here, which I skipped over, and then you can start out. Before my death, he says in the Political Testament, this is the beginning of the second part, I expel the former Reichsmarshal Hermann Goering from the party and deprive him of all rights which he may enjoy by virtue of the decree of June 29, 1941, and also by virtue of my statement in the Reichstag on September 1, 1939, I appoint in his place Gross Admiral Dönitz, President of the Reich and Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces. Before my death, I expel the former Reichsfuhrer SS and Minister of the Interior, Heinrich Himmler, from the party and from all offices of state. In his stead, I appoint, read that whole thing, he appoints Gauleiter Karl Hanke, who had been a faithful and very good Gauleiter for many years. He was a very good man. He gave him what Himmler had been. And he appointed Paul Giesler, who was another very good, from Munich, a very good Gauleiter and the brother of Hermann Giesler, who was Hitler's architect. He appointed him as Reich Minister of the Interior. So what about this expelling of these two men who had done so much for the movement and for the Third Reich?
Well, I think the Himmler and Goering are two different type of situations. So if I may, what I've studied about Himmler, aside from what anyone may think about Himmler, what I find interesting about Himmler is that Himmler seemed to honestly believe that if he approached the Allies, he would be allowed somehow to sustain or to maintain himself as with some semblance of the SS. In other words, he seemed to believe that somehow the Allies would see him as a lesser bad guy somehow, and that he would remain with some dignity or with some power. And I think that's interesting because it points to the fact that nowhere in his mind did it come up the idea that he was responsible for a genocide of millions of people, right? I mean, a person who commits a genocide of millions of people doesn't think that way. Doesn't think, hey, they'll cut me some slack, right? Because he's not acting as a guilty person, right? But anyway, that's my interpretation of it. I think it would be crazy if he actually did commit anything of this, that he would try to get some type of relief and be allowed to exist within the SS. So I think Himmler was more an issue of being somewhat deluded, in a way. And I think Goering, it's just more an issue that he was simply prohibited from contacting allies and negotiating anything without Hitler's permission. And Hitler saw it as basically a betrayal. And I guess I can understand that. I mean, if that is the order of the day, then that is the order of the day. I don't know if you have, Carolyn, but I've heard people say and argue that Goering thought that Hitler was maybe dead or he was incommunicado with Hitler. So therefore he assumed the position of, well, I guess I have to take command. And then he contacted allies or started making negotiations. I don't know if I believe that or not, but irrespective, I think that's how Hitler felt, and that's what he did.
Yes, I have heard that Goering must have come from him, that he had no news. He was cut off, and he thought that he did say, I think, that he, when they arrested him, because they did arrest him, the SS did go down there, and he was down further south and arrested him. And he told them, well, he was cut off. He thought Hitler was cut off. He thought Hitler was no longer able to do anything. And then there was this thing that these ideas people had about his health. And that he was, you know, a basket case or something, and that he could no longer function. And that he, Goering may have gotten an idea like that, and because he thought that Hitler was no longer able to function, and so he had to go ahead on his own and take over because Hitler had said on June 29th, 1941, and later on again that he was second in command if anything happened once the war started. If anything happened to Hitler, that Goering would be the next in line. And so he went ahead and did that. And obviously, Hitler didn't believe it. And he may have had information that we don't have. And so he wasn't going to stand for that. Hitler, that shows that he was totally he was in command of himself. And he wasn't doing these things out of some kind of meanness or insanity or anything. But he said, I'm in control, and we can't have these people running around no matter who they are. Saying, you know, they're in control and they're doing things. And the same with Himmler. You know, Himmler, I think, really thought, well, everything's over. You know, Hitler's not in a position to, he's not doing anything, and we need to try to make some arrangements if we can. We need to try to save Germany. This is what a lot of people had in mind. They wanted to save Germany. Anyway, that's why Himmler did what he did. I think he probably did it thinking he was doing the best thing for Germany. But what these people didn't understand, even Himmler, and this is why Hitler was so disappointed, I think, because Hitler did understand that they were never going to make any kind of an agreement with Germany that would be anything less than this unconditional surrender and the total takeover of Germany and the destruction of every last element of the National Socialism and what he stood for. So he knew that, but these others were always deluding themselves. The generals, too, well, the area was get to the West, get away from the Russians, which was true. But the West wasn't that much better. They didn't treat the soldiers that much better, the POWs, than the Russians did.
Well, you know, what's interesting, though, is that still there's a cultural element here that I find interesting, and is that Hitler believed that these men should go all the way till death, right? That they should not negotiate, that this is a fight to the death. Mm-hmm. So even if they believed that Hitler was dead, he expected them to continue until death. So even, in other words, if he hears a story that these guys thought he was dead and are surrendering somehow, this was a betrayal anyway. Even if they thought he was dead. So I think there's also a moral element here, right? Because to him, this is still a betrayal, irrespective of whether he's dead or not. And that's actually part of his order, right? You go until death. So the fact that these men, oh, he's dead, let's call these guys and quit, right? I mean, that's a
yeah, thing. So they like, so he saw them as betraying National Socialism and betraying what he had created and everything, because they obviously didn't understand it. He was terribly disappointed in Himmler. I think that they say that really hit him hard. And he was big on loyalty, you know. He was real big on loyalty and exactly what you said about going to death. Now, here's this place where he said, well, now I lost it again because I... here it is. From the sacrifice of our soldiers and from my own unity with them unto death will in any case spring up in the history of Germany the seed of a radiant renaissance. Well, that was it. That was the one thing. Then the other was that he would be with everyone in spirit who was, you know, who was working for this same cause. I don't know how much what he believed. Nobody does. But he made it out to be that that he had this belief in their spiritual unity, you know, in a spiritual togetherness, so to speak.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this kind of talk is common, especially with traditional men, right? The idea of tradition involves a connection to the past and to your ancestors. It involves a connection that goes beyond the present, right? It connects you to the future and to the past via blood. And that's why race matters, right? Because if race didn't matter, then blood doesn't matter, then ancestors don't matter, then nothing matters, right? It's pure nihilism. So this is the reason why race matters. But I also, if you don't mind really quickly, the issue of suicide is important to me.
Yes.
Because we're talking about different values and how people see things. The issue of suicide in a cultural, kind of commercial type of culture is seen as a very dark and very defeatist type of way, even though traditional cultures, I'm talking about Roman, Greek, even the samurai, right, viewed suicide as an honorable way of ending your life in certain particular situations, especially in issues in matters of war. So the act of suicide for Hitler, for example, in the 50s, as an example, was not seen as darkly as it is seen now, because now it's spinned as if suicide is some sort of weakness in the face of your enemies, because you somehow should allow them to crucify you and torture you.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what goes through these people's minds, right? But somehow committing harakiri, like the Japanese say, right? Committing suicide is seen as not a very pleasant thing, even though it has been always traditional to consider it to be an honorable thing when you are being besieged and you will not allow your enemies to kill you, to have the satisfaction of killing you, but that you will take your own life because you have honor, because you have loyalty, because you're true until death. And it's actually seen as a good sign. It was not seen as a weakness or as some sort of a dark thing. And I think that's interesting and important to point out, because if you know, most Americans are willing to accept suicide if they see it in a film about Japanese samurai and they see it as a beautiful thing. But when it's a European doing it or Hitler doing it, then it's an ugly, dark, cowardly thing, right?
Yes, very true. That was excellent. I agree totally. So all in all, you know, Hitler. Did Hitler, what mistakes did he make? I mean, let's just keep it to these last 10 days. I mean, was he a feeble old guy who was just messing around there and you know, keeping these soldiers fighting and dying while he just sat in that bunker, you know, hiding out with his group of people, you know, and of course now, well, that's the first question. Then there's the other, that they are having all these wild parties, these rumors that these Hitler haters like to pass around, and they were drunk and they're all having sex together and all that, which everybody there says nothing like that ever happened. Everything was functioning quite properly and respectfully right up to the end. And even at the end, after Hitler was gone and they had burned the bodies, and then Goebbels, and at some point Goebbels, they had given shots of morphine, is what I understand, to the children. They thought they were getting an inoculation. Then they became unconscious, and then this doctor Stumpfeger, and some people say, well, Stumpfeger didn't do it, Magda did it. Well, nobody, how do they know? They weren't there. Nobody knows, but Stumpfeger supposedly put the capsules in the children's mouths. He had agreed to do that. It must have been difficult, but what are you going to do? Then Magda and Joseph Goebbels walked upstairs into the garden by themselves. And then he shot her, and then he shot himself. And so they walked up there so that the people there wouldn't have to carry them up, you know. So they were already there, and then they buried them in a bomb crater and burned them exactly as they had done to Eva and Adolf Hitler. So this, you know, people want to make it out to be a gory thing, but it really wasn't. And Hannah Reich is one who says that everything was totally dignified in the bunker.
Well, I mean, again, this is something that countless patrician families in Rome did when they were besieged by either runaway slave armies or Hannibal, right? I mean, this is something that historically happens when you're in a position that there's no way out, and you will not allow your enemies to insult you and humiliate you, right? I mean, this is just not a pleasure you want to give to your enemies. So again, we're talking about something that historically has always been seen as something that is a last resort, but at the same time is something honorable. When it comes to what Hitler did wrong, which is the initial question you made, was he just lounging, waiting for the end? Well, a lot of times, and most of the times, Hitler understood this, right? That's why he used the term providence. He understood that a lot of times, and most of the times, we are part of a larger wheel, right, that is spinning, and we're kind of part of it. But a lot of those things we cannot control. And to somehow try to ascribe blame to him for the entire universe is ridiculous. And, of course, a lot of egalitarians and liberals do this without really thinking what they're saying, because they're basically ascribing to Hitler some kind of supernatural, all magnifying power, that he basically controlled every single soldier, every single element. He controlled time and space, that type of thing, right?
Yeah. Really?
And in that situation, and, you know, that's what's funny about that is that they're basically giving him a lot of power, right? Because they believe in him a lot more than a lot of the white nationals, right? Because they're giving him a lot of powers. But at the end of the day, he is part of history too. So at that point, what can he do, right? I mean, he did a lot, considering that, you know, most people would have said, you know what, I'll just go to bed and wait for this thing to end, because there's nothing I can do. He actually did a lot of things, and he did his best to go all the way to the max, right? And I think your show kind of proves this, right? The first hour proves this point, and I think that's what is a good thing for people to listen to.
Ah, good. I want to say I apologize at the beginning of this last segment. I don't think I did give out the phone number, and I was going to. So we still have 8 minutes to go in the program. So I will again invite anyone who wants to call in with a question or a short comment to 1-855-477-2283. We are functioning tonight on a alternative server, and the main server is not working, so we don't have as many listeners tonight as we normally do. But that's okay. We're broadcasting, and this show will be archived right after the program. Severus, let's see, what have we not covered that we still want to cover? Do you have anything that you would still like to say?
In regards to his testament, I think we said sufficiently. When it comes to one thing that I do find interesting, that if you don't mind, I would like to mention is that white nationalists have a kind of a dark tendency to allow themselves to be manipulated by the narratives of their enemies. And what happens is a lot of white nationalists, even though deep down they respect and admire Hitler, they're a little lazy to actually go through the process of studying these things. So they would rather just reject them, kind of like deny him, than actually have to go through the process of understanding and explaining it. And I think it's counterproductive, because our enemies will always use Hitler as a battering ram. It doesn't matter who you are. You could be the most egalitarian racist in the world. I don't know if that's even possible, but I guess you could be, right? If you're the most, you know, friendly liberal, you know, guy, but you just like white people, right? Even this guy is going to be blamed and called Hitlerite, a Nazi, and you can't run away from it. And when you tell someone that you're not, and when you are blamed of it, doesn't matter how many times you say you're not, they're going to think you're a hypocrite and a liar. Because any person who is a white racialist, who has 2 cents of knowledge of World War II and of Nazi Germany, will respect it and admire it. So at least have the decency to at least not fall prey to the propaganda. It doesn't mean that you have to be a national socialist. It just means that you have to be honest and acknowledge that national socialist Germany did something right. And I think that's legitimate.
Okay. I couldn't agree more. Let's see. I was going to talk about his. I really do agree with that. I've said similar to that, but you put it very well. I would like to say a few things about his private will and testament, but there's a question here from the background that says to ask you about the Blue Division if they fought to the end in Berlin. I didn't know that the Spanish SS volunteers were fighting in Berlin. Were they?
They were in all, but the Blue Division was actually a Wehrmacht division. It was not an SS division.
Yeah, that's right. They were fighting on the Eastern Front, weren't they?
Exactly.
But maybe, were they defending Berlin?
Well, actually, there was a Spanish division, which its name escapes me right now, that was actually in Berlin with the French. And, you know, what's interesting is that the last fighters in Berlin, a lot of them aside from the Hitler Youth, foreign divisions were the French, which is a Charlemagne division, which is actually an SS French division, and the Spanish division, which the name escapes me because they were actually connected with another division. And they actually did fight to the end. And I think it's a nice testament to the history, right? Because it proves that till the end, the fight was a pan-European fight. It was not only a German fight. It was a fight of Europeans. And that includes the Spaniards, the French, the Danes, the Finnish, right? I mean, this was an a European fight for survival. It was not only a German fight. And I think that's the fact that you had foreign fighters in the SS in the end, it's a great, meaningful fact that I think more people should know about and more people should celebrate because it identifies who we are.
There's not much understanding of it. And that's because only people who have a real passion for this will write about all these details. And you have to go there and find it, but you're sure not going to find it in the mainstream. Just exactly how that Waffen SS and how those volunteers, other units that were in the Wehrmacht, how they functioned. And of course, some of them didn't function too well, but that's all.
And by the way, it was the Nordland Division. They were actually joined with the Nordland Division.
The Spaniards were in the Nordland?
The Nordland, yeah, they put them in the Nordland. Yeah, Nordland.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Just as a fun fact.
Okay, thanks for that. Well, now in Hitler, since we're talking about his death and his testament, he left his will. And he said some interesting things. I get sentimental again, how he decided before the closing of his earthly career to take as his wife that girl who, after many years of faithful friendship, entered of her own free will to share her destiny with him, with his. And as at her own desire, she goes as my wife with me into death. And she didn't want to do that. She didn't ever want to be. She didn't want to live without him. She wanted to stay with him. And he says that he left everything that he possesses, insofar as it has any value, to the party. And then he says, should this no longer exist, to the state. And should the state be destroyed, no further decision of mine is necessary. Well, you know, now the state of Bavaria, I guess, has everything that he. That he owned, and they're the ones who have the rights to Mein Kampf and that whole story. They've kept that suppressed. But I wonder how much they collected and how much of it they end up giving to Jews in to compensate them for all their sufferings. Now, then he also says, my pictures in the collections which I have bought over the course of years, and of course he had a very large art collection, which he bought and paid for. He did not steal. Have never been collected for my own private purposes, but for a gallery in my hometown of Linz, which was a great dream of his. It's really sad what happened to all of that. But and you know, Hitler had money from the royalties from his book Mein Kampf. It was the bestseller, and so he made quite a bit of money from that, and that's how he built that home of his at Berchtesgaden, and also bought art and donated and did a lot of good things. Donated to a lot of art causes and so on in things that he really believed in. So he was very busy in supporting what he believed and supporting the arts too. The arts that he liked. He was not a cheap or a stingy man. He never took anything from the state. You know, there's a little story. I've got a message here. There's a little story that Traudl Junger told that right in those last 10 days, she and the ladies had gone out into the park, and it was kind of quiet, and they took the dogs out there, and they spent some time, and they saw this pretty statue, and Ava Braun really liked it. It was a little, you know, marble, you know, whatever kind of bronze statue of some nymph or something. I forget now what it was. And later, maybe that night they were having tea, and then she said she started wheedling Hitler about could he give her that statue to put in her at her home down there in Munich. She thought it would be very pretty in her garden, and she'd like to have it. And he patted her hand, and he said, and he called her child sometimes. Child, he says. He says that, I think he said, I'm not sure, but he said, I think that belongs to the nation. And he said, I can't take that. And, you know, things like that. I mean, he never took things. He never took advantage. Well, darn, I talked right through it. Goodbye, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Night, everyone.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.